never be recognized, never touched, and incredibly rich if she did it with me. By it, I meant send photos of herself to Flesh World. I told her to make a little ad saying you'll send naughty tapes, panties, and pictures for a simple fee, etc., etc. Get a safety deposit box and make up a name with a false history. We could even have Jacques take the photos tonight. We had been drinking at the cabin for a couple of hours when I told Jacques that I wanted some Polaroids taken of me. The red window curtains were a large enough backdrop, and the color was just sleazy enough so that if I posed the right way, I'd sell a million copies. Jacques and Leo were both excited by what I was doing. I found a new way to seduce them. Ronette saw me in action and decided perhaps it was a good idea after all. Soon, Laura. July 22nd, 1988. Dear Diary, happy sweet 16 to me. Everything feels like a dream. A bad, very sad dream about a little girl who all her life had a dream of her life at sweet 16. God, Diary, I had such beautiful images of the boy who would love me and never leave my side, of how my girlfriends and I would drive my new car to the beach, strip down to our bikinis and jump into the water. I would have the perfect body, the perfect skin, the perfect family and home, a straight-A student who is helpful and earns her own money. I wanted my own pony, a cat, and maybe a dog. Donna Hayward would be right by my side, wearing a lacy white dress, and our boyfriends would pick us up at the front door. Our parents loved them because we had the perfect parents. All of the above were the making of my dreams until my nightmare arrived. Not certainly that I thought I would have all of these picture-perfect moments in my life, but I still had dreams, hope that anything was possible. I cannot tell you how special and valuable a daydream is. I didn't miss it until it was gone. Without it, I became cold, paranoid, unfriendly, and open to all sorts of horrible things. Most of the truth you already know. Sweet 16 is not what I thought it would be. Bobby Briggs and I decided we would take a bit of a breather from one another. I think he is having a little affair with Shelley. No matter. I can't love Bobby the way he deserves to be loved. And it kills me inside to admit that. I am not side by side with Donna Hayward. Something has happened to us. We grew up together, but then I suddenly grew apart from her. Certain events aged me, made me bitter. I see that I wrongly believed her a fool because she had not been made bitter. No one came late at night from the woods to reassure her there is no hope. No, that was my life. I do not have a brand new car. My parents lend me theirs. Why should I have one in the town of Twin Peaks? There isn't really much need. I try to work hard, but I must do more. I must work harder to redeem all my evil doings. My cocaine binges. All day, all night, for months. I'm an addict, and I forced Bobby to sell drugs by threatening to leave him if he didn't. I know now that he would never take me back. I don't deserve him anyway. handsome exterior with a heart of gold. My fantasy man. I have to quit the coke and the sex. More than a girl my age should know. Much more. Sex that grows darker and darker. Becomes an act of vengeance rather than love. I love to sleep with women sometimes because I know exactly how to please them. And it gives me so much control. I long for such strength all of the time, which again explains the cocaine. I often fear that all of my actions will send me to hell. I had a pony, a beautiful one, Troy. His mane, a rich cinnamon color. Once again, I blame myself. Although there may be circumstances in my life that led me to believe what I did was right, it doesn't count. I led him out, caught up in my own dream of freedom. I whipped his ass hard. I watched him take off. And I believe he looked back once. But I turned away. Somehow, I already sensed what would happen to him because of me. He was found, unfed, unshod, with a broken leg on the tracks by the border. Benjamin Horn watched him silently accept two bullets into his skull. I have become a thief, like the visitor Bob is, stealing pride and hope, confidence, my cat, I won't go into. It is sad enough just to think about. I have to go. More later, Laura. July 22nd, 1988. Dear Diary, enough of the past. And how I go on and on about the faults of the present. I have some news that comes to me like a slap across the face. I am pregnant. 7.5 weeks pregnant. No one knows but you and the women at the clinic. I borrowed the car today to go see a doctor and be sure. I'm sure. I have so many voices in my head right now. I haven't done a line of coke since last night. Seems like forever. I wish all of my life were a dream. One grand, strange dream with many realistic plot lines and relationships. But this can't be the life of Laura Palmer. I try so hard to do well. Why? I have no idea whose baby this is. I cannot cry any longer today because it is my 16th birthday, and everyone will want to know why it is that I am so upset. I'm not going to tell anyone. Laura. August 2nd, 1988. Dear Diary, it has been an entire week since Bob has come to see me. I am so numb that it actually occurred to me the other day that I wished he would come and cut me the way he used to. Take some of this constant thinking again and again away by simply bleeding it out of me. Of course, he would not dare show up if I wanted him to. I think of death these days as a companion I long to meet. Goodbye, Laura.
Little bitch.
Are you there, Pop?
Always.
Why don't you just come take me now? Take my life. Now.
Too easy.
That's bullshit. I'm going insane. I can't live anymore like this. Either get out of my fucking head right now. Get out of my life. Out of my home. Out of my dreams. Or kill me.
You take all the fun out of it.
So I was right from the beginning. It has always been your goal to kill me.
Sometimes life is about what happens before death. I wanted to see what could be done.
I'm an experiment.
Yes. You've said that once before.
I've never had a chance.
Sure you have.
I don't believe you.
Nobody does. That is why you are falling.
Falling?
Into darkness. Nice, isn't it?
No.
No.
I told you. I hate this. I hate myself and everything around me.
That's too bad.
Are you real, Bob?
To you, I am the only reality there is.
But
you keep coming back. You always say you're going to stop doing bad things. You never stop.
When you first came to me, I was not doing bad things. I was a baby girl. I was nothing. I was all goodness. I was happy.
Incorrect.
I could talk to you forever and never learn a thing.
Someone of wisdom is always more difficult to communicate with. This is the fire you must walk through.
I don't want to hear about fire.
Then you don't want the answer.
Who are you, really?
I am what you fear I could be.
Enough. I understand. It's enough. I have to go. Go away now. Please. Just leave.
Happy last days, Laura's baby.
I've gone insane. I won't be talking with you for a while. Al. August 10th, 1988. Dear Diary, it is difficult to describe without sounding self-pitying, although this is only half the truth. It was over in only a few moments, and yet I heard all sorts of sounds, worlds going by, life spinning on its heels and running away. The doctor came in, his large hands already wrapped in rubber gloves, and his eyes as sterile as the room and utensils used there. He shook my hand. The rubber glove reminded me of something. Was it Bob? The last few moments with the baby were the hardest I've ever been through. What kind of decision was I making? Whose baby was it? The doctor swung his arms up into the air and said, "Damn sleeves." He pushed his sleeves up and went to work. Machines began to whir. The nurse in the room took hold of my hand. She smiled. And the doctor leaned between my spread legs and hovered there for a moment. He looked down at me and said, "There will be some discomfort." And so I closed my eyes and took hold of the nurse's hand. I wished that whoever this child was would come back when the time is right, when there is a marriage, a union that you were born of, not responsible for. You, child, should be a gift to those who are ready, not a burden, like so many others before you. Come back, child, when I am no longer a child myself. Laura. August 10th, 1988. Dear Diary, I cried all the way back from the clinic and thought of all the things that had happened to me, or that I had let happen to me within the past few months. I wish Maddie could have been here with me. I almost called to ask her if she would come, but decided not to. My only real sense of gratification came from the fact that as of today, 1 a.m., I am 19 days sober. No coke. It has been much harder than I ever thought it would be. Sometimes, simply out of habit, I'll check the bedpost for any remaining film on the paraphernalia I still keep in the space there. By the way, I forgot to tell you Norma called me a couple of days ago, and we're meeting tomorrow to discuss my idea for helping the elderly of Twin Peaks. I hope it all works out because this could be beneficial to the town, as well as my sobriety. Once I got home, I realized how much pain I was in. I didn't think I would even make it up the stairs to my room. Mom caught up to me instantly and said, "So how'd it go?" "The interview was just fine, Mom." I gripped the banister tightly and told her I was heading to bed early. I could feel her watching me as I went up step by step. Just as I was at the top of the staircase, Mom called up to me and said that I had had a phone call from Cousin Maddie. I stood there in awe. Maddie had heard my calling to her. In that same moment, I was aware of Mom's stare. Pure jealousy at my back. I've got to rest. Laura. August 16th, 1988, 3:15 a.m. Dear Diary, it has been some time now since the two of us have met this late at night. Sobriety is a bitch. I've never been more paranoid than I have been these past few days. I feel like I've lost all of my friends because I'm sober. Ronette and I don't talk the way we used to, especially at work. And I am not notified of parties taking place up at the cabin anymore. Bobby never really calls. I call him. How weird is that? He seems to be fine without me, which makes me feel like everyone will notice that and stop dealing with me altogether. I wonder, am I the bad influence Bob always tells me I am? Does my sobriety mean I will end up totally alone? Even my new friend Harold Smith. August 20th, 1988, 5:20 a.m. Dear Diary, it is very dark in my room right now, and I am only writing to you by the glow of the nightlight. I do not want anyone to see me awake. I feel so scared. I just had a nightmare and now I'm sweating like crazy and can hardly breathe. In the dream, everyone in the world was taking drugs, but I had stopped. I don't know why. Maybe it made me feel better. I think I thought it was the right thing to do. As soon as I'd stopped, I became invisible. I broke up into empty space and floated around Twin Peaks. Through school, no one noticed me. No one. I ran into a classroom and saw Donna. I walked right up to her and screamed in her face, but she didn't hear me. Bobby and Shelley were walking toward me in the hall. They were speaking to each other and they walked right through me. When I turned to go after them, I saw Leo and Jacques by the drinking fountain. Even they didn't see me. I couldn't get anyone's attention or make them believe that I mattered because to them, I didn't. They couldn't see me because I was sober. The whole dream seemed so real. I felt so alone. When I looked up to check the light from the hallway, there outside the window, looking in at me, laughing, his sounds and laughter muted by the glass, was Bob, son of a bitch. I saw his face across the room, highlighted by the orangish glow of my nightlight. Only a pane of glass separated us. He kept laughing and then lowered himself slowly out of the square that is my window. I was unable to rest until the sun rose, and the window held the light that does not allow him to return. Love, Laura. August 20th, 1988, later. Dear Diary, Mr. Battis had asked that I meet with him in his office at 5:30. At 5:15, I told Ronette that I should go, but I'd be back as soon as I could to help her unload the new products. I was left alone in Battis's office for several minutes. I took a seat in the chair in front of his desk. When Mr. Battis walked in, he took a quick look at me and smiled. He liked me. I knew that. But now it was even more obvious. Mr. Battis took two steps toward his window and looked out between the curtains. Something tells me that you were in the market for a better job.
Yes. I crossed my legs. That's true.
Still looking out the window, he said, I believe we have the job for you.
And what would that be,
Mr. Battis?
I said.
A hostess, with room to grow.
A hostess?
Can you dance, Miss Palmer?
Amory, I can do a lot of things.
Then you can make a lot of money. Mr. Battis told me to meet him here next Saturday, and we, Ronette included, would go to a place across the border called One-Eyed Jack's.
I thanked him and left his office. Walking back to the perfume counter, I made the decision that sobriety was not for me. Ronette said she'd cover for me a while. I took her bullet back to the storage room. I took my hits, turned to leave, and there was Bob, crouched in the corner, smiling victoriously. New game. Laura. August 23rd, 1988. Dear Diary, I feel so much better with cocaine back in my life. I've been meaning to tell you what became of my meeting with Norma. I had been thinking about the very best way to help the elderly who find it difficult to leave the house. I would deliver meals to the elderly people in the area who couldn't get out for a hot meal. I told her the name of the program could be Meals on Wheels. Norma loved the idea and said she would make a few calls to people at City Hall and maybe the hospital. We could find the best recipients that way without doing much footwork. Norma agreed to provide the meals. 2 a day, 4 times a week. All profits to go 50-50. I deliver them to the door, and maybe I'll regain some confidence. Or am I confident? Or am I so fucked up on coke that I can't tell? So, today, I came to pick up 2 meals at the diner. I was helping Norma pull the meals from the oven when Josie Packard came in. She and Norma had a quick talk, during which Josie became a bit upset, emotional. Norma called me over and explained that Josie was being hassled at the mill again about her English. I could tell she was embarrassed by it. I told her that I'd love to give her English lessons if she'd like. Norma gave me a smile and a pat on the shoulder. Josie stepped forward and said, "I'd be more than happy to pay you for these services." I shook her hand, and she said that her first available day was next Monday evening. I told her that was fine. I would see her Monday. I left the diner with the meals. I had to deliver them and get up to Johnny Horn's in 45 minutes. I went to Mrs. Tremone's apartment first. I left the tray at the front door along with the appropriate note and a request for a house key of my own. Harold Smith was my other delivery. As I think I told you, he's an interesting man. Very handsome. Apparently, he was a botanist. For some reason, he can't remember. He awoke one morning to find himself an agoraphobic. He believes death is just outside the door, and that late at night, it calls to him from outside like a strange bird. He invited me in, but I was already late, so I told him I'd have to take a rain check. I got up to the Horns, and they were all ready to leave. I told them to have a good time, that Johnny and I would be fine, not to worry. I convinced Bobby to drop some coke off for me, and Johnny and I spent the evening reading his storybooks and eating ice cream. More later. Laura. August 31st, 1988. Dear Diary, I just reread yesterday's entry and I suddenly feel very embarrassed about being alive. The girl who received this diary on her 12th birthday has been dead for years. And I, who took her place, have done nothing but make a mockery of the dreams she once had. I'm 16 years old. I'm a cocaine addict. A prostitute who fucks her father's employers. Not to mention half the fucking town. And the only difference from last week is that now I'm getting paid for it. My life is whatever the other person in the room wants it to be. Therefore, when I am alone, my life is nothing. I dreamed last night that I was outside Jacques' cabin in the woods, and I was trying to find a way inside. There was no front door, only a window, identical to the one in my bedroom. I looked through the window and saw Waldo flying back and forth very, very slowly. It was as if he were moving in slow motion, but I could tell that he was panicked. He called out, "Laura, Laura," as if in warning, and suddenly Bob stepped into the square of the window and grabbed Waldo in his hands. Bob turned to me, smiling. And with one squeeze, crushed Waldo to death. I backed away from the window and ran from the house as fast as I could. No matter where I turned, the house was always in front of me, and each time I saw Bob, he was closer to climbing out of the window. I fell to my knees. Everything went silent. I looked up, and there, 30 feet in front of me, was a gigantic owl. As I look back now, I am still unsure. Was he a friend or an enemy? We stood staring at each other for a long time. It felt as if he wanted to say something, but he did not. I awoke, hoping that what the log lady said, owls are sometimes big, referred to tonight and meant that something good was going to happen to me. Now that I'm working at One-Eyed Jack's, I could use a good omen. I will pay attention to everything the way the log lady told me I should. I suspect that this will be the first of many things I will need to pay close attention to. Laura. P.S. I think that in order to ensure my privacy, I will need to start a second diary. One that, if found, will give the intruder the Laura that everyone thinks lives inside of me. I will have to spend time filling its pages. I wonder if life is still something I can make up. November 13th, 1988. Dear Diary, I was up at the Horns' having a session with Johnny. One of his doctors, Dr. Lawrence Jacoby, joined us to shoot a few rubber buffalo. I was immediately aware of Lawrence's attraction to me. Not that that was the issue, but where his attraction came from was he had fallen in love with the two Lauras. The very reasons for which I wanted so desperately to die, what I considered a curse, he found enticing and honest. He did not mock my pain. He accepted it. So Dr. Jacoby and I began to meet secretly at his office. He just lets me talk, and I will sometimes try to shock him with the details of my darker self. Yet he continues to accept them. Accept me. Always recognizing that the lighter part of me never wanted to do them in the first place. And so he forgives me. I know this may sound very sick and mean, perhaps, but I am almost consumed at times with hatred for him because never has he turned to me and confirmed my deepest fears that I am becoming like Bob. Bad. Maybe it is the way he says it is. I have simply forgotten how to be loved. Laura. January 13th, 1989. Dear Diary, I haven't been writing to you because Dr. Jacoby gave me a pretty hot pink tape recorder for Christmas. He said that it might help me to talk into it. I sent him the tapes after I have listened to them myself. I find that even though I'm still very sad, that listening to the tapes and all that they say helps me feel that the problems spoken on them are not my own. I would write more often. But with all my work and the other diary I must keep pleasantly updated, I have hardly any time to be as honest as I am with you. I will write more when I can. Laura. March 27th, 1989. Dear Diary, I had been promising to spend a few moments with Harold for weeks now, and finally today I was able to do so. His apartment is small, and filled with books from the toilet tank to the top of the fridge. I think he has to keep reading these stories because he so rarely has any stories of his own. I like to play with Harold sometimes. I like the way he hangs on my every word as I describe some of my adventures. In particular, those from One-Eyed Jack's, where, by the way, Jacques works as a blackjack dealer. My stories stimulate Harold. I know that. But yet he reacts almost violently and with fear when I make advances toward him, no matter how mild. I love Harold's tenderness and most often feel wonderful when I am with him and when I think about him. But sometimes I hate myself more than you can imagine for the aroused feelings I get when I see Harold's frightened face, which must be the same thing Bob sees when he looks at me. The prey, cornered, so degraded, made a toy. I am noticing that more and more, and I think Bob is too, when he visits me, that I cannot hurt or be hurt enough lately. Laura. June 4th, 1989. Dear Diary, I have been working with Josie on her English lessons for a while now, and she shows very few signs of improvement or efforts to improve. I know that Josie was a dancer and a prostitute in Hong Kong when Andrew fell in love with her and saved her life by bringing her here 6 years ago. And I think she still has more of that lifestyle in her than most realize. She's treating our sessions more like poorly executed seductions, and the more she comes on to me, the less I respect her. It's not that she's all over me. It's different than that. She mentions Bobby a lot, and I can tell she is jealous of him. She makes too many insinuations to my sexual goings-on for me to believe she is not a darker person than the town thinks. Poor Sheriff Truman. Laura. P.S. Makes me sick how every time I do something good, I always end up, pardon the pun, getting fucked. August 6th, 1989. Dear Diary, Norma had taken care of almost all the deliveries that week, but asked if I would handle Mr. Pendergast, since she had to go visit her husband, Hank, in prison that afternoon. I told her I'd be happy to. I have 16 keys on my keychain other than the 5 that are my own. Every so often, I daydream of the fantastic access I have to homes that are not my own. I understand the thrill a burglar must feel upon entering an apartment and suddenly being able to decide that anything in sight is his own. Mr. Pendergast is the most trusting and the most kind of any of the elderly I deliver to. I inserted the key into his door and entered quietly. I could hear the television on in his bedroom and called out to him that I was there. He did not answer. When I found him, he was behind his bedroom door, his hands still tight to the doorknob as if he had used it as a support in his attempt to move, simply through his own house. For a man who was so gentle, I thought it was a shame that he should die wearing such an expression of struggle. The look in his eyes and the shape of his mouth told me he felt left behind and betrayed by his friends. I waited almost an hour before I phoned for the ambulance. I sat down next to him, and watched him, so still, holding death. I do not think that hour there told me anything I could not have imagined myself. But being there, in that silence, gave me hope that at least there are no wars after death. I have seen more death than I have seen life. Sometimes even the most tired clichés apply. I believe I am merely living my life in order to die. Laura. October 5th, 1989. Dear Diary, in the middle of my shift last night at One Eye Jack's, I left my room and went into the office. I wanted to use the bathroom there because it had a lock on it. I had come down so hard that I needed more than just a bullet hit. I needed a couple big fat lines. When I exited the bathroom, I used the other door which connects to Blackie's room. She was on the bed, with a tourniquet on her arm shooting heroin. I may be fucked up, but I don't shoot that shit up my arm. That's an idiot's drug. Blackie leaned her head back, having obviously just caught the high. I said to her directly, "I came in here for my money." Euphoric and a bit patronizingly, she said, "You'll get it tonight." "That's what you told me last night." I paused. "Maybe if you stopped shooting that shit up your arm, you wouldn't forget the things you've said." Blackie stood up, settling into her high, and said that she was sick of my little girl attitude and that I should grow up. She also added that she thought I should stop frolicking in the snow, that the customers were beginning to notice. I told her that was ridiculous. The customers hadn't noticed anything but better sex and better service than they'd ever had there before. "But they haven't fucked me yet," Blackie replied. I hesitated purposely, then said, "Oh, I thought that fucking you was punishment for those who..." Blackie interrupted me with a slap across my face. She looked me in the eye and said, "I'm gonna teach you a thing or two about fucking right now." I smiled the way Bob would and thought to myself, "I'll be the one teaching the lesson." By the time I left Blackie, she was on the floor, naked except for her jewelry, and was humiliated because I had been able to take total control and show her things she had never thought possible. I took her into a very dark, erotic place, but I left her there alone. As I opened the door, Blackie threw her final and only remaining punch. "You better watch that cocaine use, Laura. It could get you fired." I knew right then that it was to be my last night at One Eye Jack's. Laura. P.S. I'm going to have to tell the world about Benjamin. October 10th, 1989. Dear Diary, I phoned Josie and told her I wouldn't be able to make the lesson that night until at least 10 o'clock. She said that was fine and that she would be waiting for me. That night, I took advantage of the fact that someone wanted me so badly. And yet I found myself, as always, instructing my partner on how to please me. This experience in particular left me feeling empty and angry, and without respect for yet another person in town. Laura. P.S. On the way home from Josie's, I had a horrible vision of little Danielle running up to me to explain that Bob had been visiting her. He had told her I had sent him to her. When I came out of the vision, I realized that Bob had not come to visit me in over a week. I hoped that this was only a vision, and not a premonition. Perhaps I should warn Danielle. October 31st, 1989. Dear Diary, it's Halloween. No mask necessary. Blackie's sister, Nancy from One Eyed Jack's, brought my clothes and the money they owed me stuffed into a plastic pumpkin. She asked if she could talk to me outside for a moment because... Undated. Dear Diary, I spent the afternoon with Dr. Jacoby at his office. He wanted to see me and go over what I had said to him on my tapes. He wanted to hear more about James Hurley and the fact that I had mentioned going sober because of him. I told him James was someone I had known for a long time, although not so well. I told him I had fallen in love with his purity and the idea that if I was strong enough, I could let James take me out of this darkness. I told him that it was a secret relationship only because I had wanted it that way. Donna knows, but the three of us are friends at school, so I know she won't tell Bobby. I told Dr. Jacoby how hard it had been for me lately with everything getting so close, and how I finally felt certain that James was my last chance for light. I feel like a fake, I told him, even though I was homecoming queen. I had such a story behind my smile in the photos, and at the football game as well. I still felt the hands and the mouths of the men I had been with hours before the photo was taken. I told him I had worn the same panties just in case Bob came. I told him it felt like the school and the town and the world were mocking me by voting me homecoming queen. How could they not see how I was being swallowed up by pain? How dare they make me a spectacle like that and ask me to smile again and again and again? At the game, Bobby was the hero he wanted to be. But from the stands, I could hardly make him out on the field. Everything seemed far away and muted, as if the blood rushing through my head hushed all the sounds except for my heartbeat and my breathing, which seemed labored, erratic. I told him I had been having awful nightmares, all of them about the woods, the paths, the tree, footprints, the sounds of an owl. I felt death in these dreams, and I also felt lust. Lust like I had known when it was fresh to me, and it wasn't tired and worn out and bettered only by violence. I did have one dream, the worst, about water. In the dream, I was standing at the water's edge, and the sky was very, very dark. But reflected on the surface of the water was the sky filled with white clouds and a deep blue color. I remember thinking in the dream that if I dove in and swam far enough, I might come up in another world that was not filled with so much badness, so much hatred. When I did dive in, I remember swimming half the length of the lake. I think it was a lake, only to be pulled down by a hand as it grabbed my wrist and took me deeper and deeper and deeper. I told him I thought that hand was Bob's. I told Dr. Jacoby that the last time I had seen Leo and Jacques had not been very nice. We had all been fooling around, and they had tied me up in this chair, but I started to get this feeling of claustrophobia. Restriction. I started to panic and hyperventilate, and I tried to explain what was happening, but it was difficult to speak, and no one realized I was being serious. I started to get very lightheaded, and there were flashes of light in my eyes, and I was finally able to scream out for them to stop. This was not all right. I was not all right. We had been playing one of the games we play a lot, where I am trapped in a cabin far, far away from any help, and that I am a virgin, and they are men who have been sent from a strange and erotic place to take my virginity and to punish me for resisting them. And so Leo heard me say this was not all right. But he thought it was part of the game, and he said, "Oh, is the little virgin scared?" It went on like that, and I started rocking the chair back and forth, and I guess Leo was really into it, as was Jock, and Leo got a little crazy and he hit me hard. Too hard. My ears rang. I began to cry. It wasn't until then that Jock said, "Wait a minute, she's not okay." They untied me and I ran home without saying a word. Leo's slap had left an ugly bruise on my cheek. I had to tell my parents that this horrible black and blue mark came from when I was carrying a dinner tray from Harold's apartment. I told Dr. Jacoby I missed Donna, and I wished that she and Ronette would like each other. I wished that we could all be friends so I wouldn't have to hide anything from anyone. I told him about how I had gone to Harold's last week. Really fucked up. And how scared I made him by coming on to him pretty heavy. And then, basically because he could not leave his house, forced him to have sex with me. I told Dr. Jacoby that I cried for hours afterward because I felt so horrible. It took Harold almost an hour to talk to me because I had made him scared, even in his own home, his only refuge. And then I told Dr. Jacoby that half the time I hated it, and the rest of the time it made me feel strong and hot between the legs. On the way out of Harold's, Mrs. Tremond's grandson, Pierre, saw me and came up to me and pulled a gold coin out of my ear and walked away. I told him that Bob was getting very, very close and that I was trying as hard as I could to write about him to find out what he was, who he was, before he could get to me. I had been writing so much about him in my diary and poems and dreams, and each time I did it, I would see him at my window or feel him coming closer. But I wasn't sure if it was paranoia. I just wanted to be normal. I just want to be like everybody else. I don't like having to be careful of who to talk to because someone might hate me if they knew the truth about me. About how dirty I am, and how somehow, I don't remember it, but somehow, every day, I ask to be treated this way. It always happens, so it must be something I don't realize I say, or something I think. I told him how I went to my safety deposit box, and now I saw the drug money there, and I had a fantasy about taking it and running away forever. But I didn't deserve that. I deserved to stay here. I had done something wrong. My heart hurt so badly, but I knew I had to stay. I took the responses from my ad in Flesh World home with me and stayed up all night putting pictures of me and my panties into envelopes, and how I had to keep getting higher and higher on coke so I wouldn't break down and cry, and I didn't want anyone to hear my cries because they didn't matter to them anyway. They never have. Love Laura. Undated. Dear Diary, I know who he is. I know exactly who and what Bob is. And I have to tell everyone. I have to tell someone and make them believe. Someone has torn pages out of my diary, pages that help me realize, maybe, pages with my poems, pages of writing, private pages. I'm so afraid of death. I'm so afraid that no one will believe me until after I have taken the seat that I fear has been saved for me in the darkness. Please don't hate me. I never meant to see the small hills and the fire. I never meant to see him or let him in. Please, Diary, help me explain to everyone that I did not want what I have become. I did not want to have certain memories and realizations of him. I only did what any of us can do in any situation. My very best. Love, Laura. P.S. I'm giving you to Harold for safekeeping. I hope I see you again. I can't stay sober anymore. I just can't. I have to be numb.
The proceeding was Laura's last entry. She was found dead just days later.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, written by Jennifer Lynch, performed by Cheryl Lee. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 1990 Twin Peaks Productions, Inc. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.